You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Over 13 months in 1976-77, four children were abducted in the Detroit suburbs, each of them held for days before their still warm bodies were dumped in the snow near public roadsides. The Oakland County child murder spawned panic across southeast Michigan, triggering the most extensive manhunt in U.S. history. Yet after less than 2 years, the task force created to find the killer was shut down without naming a suspect. The case went cold for more than 30 years, until a chance discovery by one victim's family pointed to the son of a wealthy General Motors executive. Christopher Brian Bush, a four-time convicted pedophile, was freed weeks before the fourth child disappeared. Veteran Detroit news reporter Marnie Rich Keenan takes the reader inside the investigation of the still unsolved murders, seen through the eyes of the lead detective in the case and the family who cracked it open, revealing evidence of a decades-long cover-up of malfeasance and obstruction that averted justice for the victims. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Snow Killings, Inside the Oakland County Killer Investigation, with my special guest journalist and author, Marnie Rich Keenan. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Marnie Rich Keenan.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for joining me. This is an extraordinary book and an incredible case and incredibly disturbing. Let's get right to this. Give us your background and how you came to this story, when you became involved. Give us the particulars.
Sure. I'm a journalist. I've worked for newspapers and magazines for several decades. The last 26 years of my career, I was a reporter and columnist for the Detroit News. I grew up here in Oakland County, so I knew the crimes well. And anybody who lived here during that time was deeply affected and had never forgotten it. The entire Metro Detroit area had been terrorized, and specifically Oakland County, which is just northwest of the city. I think it had about 1 million residents at the time. Was in a state of full panic, and so that Oakland County has long been ranked among the top 5 or 10 affluent counties in the nation. It was home to auto barons and wealthy entrepreneurs who had built their summer homes and estate cottages here. So when these crimes occurred, families, enjoyed nice neighborhoods and nationally ranked schools. And for something like this to happen was almost inconceivable. And in hindsight, many of us will agree that we were both naive and in denial, really. I came to the case because I had interviewed Barry King over the years. I was a columnist and had interviewed him on anniversaries of the crimes. Of course, Barry King was the father of the fourth victim.
Right.
And one night in October, he called me and my editor to his house. And we were there for 3 hours, and he started the conversation by saying, the story I'm about to tell you started in a big white house right across the street. And when he ended the interview, he said, my family and I think we know who killed. Right. And that, of course, was the story of Pat Coffey and Chris Bush. But maybe I should provide you with an introduction of the crimes.
Well, you also do that in the book. You start off on January 15th, 1976, but you say the story must begin a full month before the first victim was snatched. So in January 15th, this story starts with Cynthia Cadeau, a 16-year-old high school student. Tell us a little bit more about this and why this is necessary to know before we talk about the four murders that constitute the Oakland County child killings.
Well, in the same time as our four kids went missing, there were three young women. They were older. They were teenagers who were also wound up missing and their bodies soon discovered afterwards. So this only increased the fear and panic in the area. It wasn't too long before police decided that these three murders of these three girls were not related to our four Oakland County child killing kids, because they were able to solve them quite readily and because they were older and their kidnappings and manner of death didn't fit the pattern that our four did. Nonetheless, there was a total of seven kids who went missing to begin with, and that only heightened the fear.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to February 15th, 1976, and Mark Douglas Stebbins, which is 12 years old. Tell us a little bit about what happens.
So around lunchtime, Mark Stebbins was at the American Legion Hall in Ferndale with his mother and his older brother, and there was a pool tournament there. His mother worked there, and he wanted to go home to watch a movie on TV. And so he said goodbye to his mother and his brother, and he started to walk the few blocks home on the sidewalk, but he never arrived home. His body was found 4 days later, lying against a partition wall in a neighborhood shopping plaza, a strip mall, in the nearby town of Southfield. And then this was followed by 3 days after Christmas, Jill Robinson, who was 12 years old, close to dinner time, had left her mom's house in Royal Oak. She'd had a bit of a disagreement with her mom over making dinner. She left her mom's house in Royal Oak. Her parents were divorced, and she jumped on her bike, presumably to ride to her father's house in nearby Birmingham. But she, too, disappeared. 4 days later, the day after Christmas, Jill's body was spotted by a passing motorist along I-75 in the pull-off lane, I guess you would call it, near an exit, and she had been shot in the face. Only a week later, as it turns out, on January 2nd, the day after New Year's Day, Christine Mihalik, who was 10 years old, to her home in Berkeley at about 3 in the afternoon. She wanted to walk up to the nearby 7-Eleven store to buy a teen magazine for Christmas. She'd been given an album by one of her idols, Donny and Marie Osmond, and this teen magazine that she was after had Donny and Marie Osmond on the cover. Right. And the clerk remembered, you know, selling her a magazine. And Christine was seen walking home along 12 Mile Road, but then she vanished. It seems hard to think of this, but Christine was gone the longest. She was gone 19 days.
Incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, it's her mother, Deborah Jarvis, said to me that the reason she thinks Christine was kept so long was because Christine was so delightful and so sweet to be around. In any event, Christine was gone 19 days, and on January 2nd, the day after New Year's Day, a mailman was delivering mail to in a residential area in nearby Franklin, and when he saw something blue in the snowbank, and it turned out to be Christine's jacket. Of course, after Christine, law enforcement knew they had child serial killer on their hands. Christine's parents appealed to their captor on TV. They organized citizen searches on foot. CB Radio Club members, I don't know if people even know now what CB radios are, but they joined in the effort, and the case was all over newspapers and TV, and experts warned that if the maniac was not, you know, apprehended, he would surely strike again. And so now, as I said, police knew they had a serial killer on their hands. So Robert Robertson, who was then commander of the Criminal Investigative Division of the Michigan State Police, had phoned several police chiefs from jurisdictions where, you know, either the kids were snatched or where their bodies had been found. And he pulled them all together in an auditorium. And that was the meeting. Where they became known as, where they formed the Oakland County Child Killings Task Force.
Okay, so they have the three children connected.
Yes.
And they find evidence of sexual assault. They have actual sperm found in the vagina and rectum. They also have, you talked about Michigan State Police Lieutenant Robert Robertson organizing other police from other jurisdictions and Oakland County as well. You also say that the effort that they did at that time, including Detective Sergeant Kreese, which was the day-to-day operations he was in charge of, what are some of the things that they did to try to search for these potential offenders?
Boy, they did an amazing amount of things. This is, of course, before Tim went missing, but they had their postal carriers come all together, and they developed a profile of the suspect and delivered that profile to anybody and everybody. The one of the problems was, since none of the kids, there was no witness, nobody had heard any screams from these abductions, nobody had seen any kid forced into a car, and as a result, everybody became, the police thought the children must have gone with their captor willingly. They must have recognized who it was. And as a result, you know, everybody became suspect. Members of the clergy, teachers, coaches. They went into schools and Police officers had teachers quiz children to see if there was anything, you know, untoward going on in the kids' lives that they wouldn't necessarily bring up to their folks. Some kids were even fingerprinted. It was a massive, massive search, but as one, and tips came in, and they started, I think they pulled the records on all the known sexual offenders at the time, and
right.
But every one of them had alibis. And then a couple of months passed after Christine and then Jim King on March 16th, 1977, Tim, who was the youngest of Marion and Barry King's four children. He was 11 years old, and he borrowed 30 cents from his older sister, Kathy, to walk two blocks up to a nearby pharmacy, a drugstore, called the Hunter Maple Pharmacy, to buy a candy bar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, Tim had been well-schooled in stranger danger. Everybody knew what was going on. And
right.
Tim had also been seeing his folks for a long time, to be able to stay home alone. He was 11, and Kathy really thought, it would be fine for him to, you know, walk the two blocks up to buy
yeah.
a candy bar. So she loaned him the 30 cents. It was, I think a Wednesday night, his parents had gone out to dinner at a nearby restaurant, which was actually Kitty Corner from where Tim would be abducted. Barry, who was a well-respected attorney, and his wife, Marion, were going to have a will signing with a client couple and then have dinner. Tim's brother, Chris, who had just turned 16, was babysitting. And Mark, his other brother, was at a play practice at his middle school. And Kathy was getting ready to go to see Jerry Lewis do a stand-up routine at a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So Kathy told him, you know, she'd leave the front door unlocked for him to be able to return. And she told him to be very careful crossing Adams Road. And Tim left at about 7:45, I think, and Kathy left 15 minutes later. Marion and Marion were arrived home at 9 p.m. They were followed by Mark and Chris, and Tim was nowhere to be found. They called their friends and neighbors. Chris King told me a story about getting in the car with his by friends' houses and scan backyards, and by now it was late. And Tim said they drove up to one house and it was, you know, it was pitch black. And he said, "Mom, I'll just go up and knock on the door anyway." And she said, "No, you know," she said, "it's no use." And Chris said, you know, from that moment on, it was horrible because you knew what was going on.
There was a witness that was
yes.
said that somebody, he saw a man speaking to Tim. And from that description, what was the description, but also the description of a potential vehicle?
Yes. Which turned out to be one of the case's worst red herrings. But
sure.
A day or so after Tim disappeared, a woman had told police that she had just finished grocery shopping for the night. The night, Tim was missing. And she was loading her groceries into her car, and she said she saw a kid she identified as Tim because he was wearing his red hockey jacket. And Tim, she said, was talking to a man who she described in detail. He had long, dark hair with sideburns. He was, I think she said he was between 25 and 30 years old. And she said they were both standing by a blue AMC Gremlin with a white hockey stripe. Of course, thereafter, the entire area, you know, was blanketed by posters, you know, showing up the police composite of the sketch of the suspect and the gremlin. And police thereafter, you know, just sought out every owner. I think they got a list of every owner, of nearly every owner of a gremlin in the state. It was something like 8,000 owners. They ended up pulling over 3,000 gremlins. But it would take a long time to learn that the blue gremlin was probably not the car they should be looking for.
Right.
That myth became very hard to dispel. I should note that night, that Tim went missing, Chris couldn't sleep, and so his older brother, who was 16, so he grabbed a baseball bat and he walked up to the Hunter Maple Pharmacy parking lot. And there were three or four cars parked in the lot, and one of them was an AMC Gremlin with a white hockey stripe. And he remembered looking in the car. And there was nothing. But when police came and interviewed the Kings, Chris had told them about how really the gremlin couldn't be the suspect's vehicle because he had seen it later that night, long after Tim had gone missing. But for whatever reason, the police discounted, you know, a 16-year-old's version when, you know, up against a person who had said she witnessed him.
Now let's talk about Dr. Bruce Danto just briefly, because this is obviously to no avail, but this guy offers to develop a profile, of course, free assistance. So he has a theory.
Yes.
Basically,
yes.
What's his theory? And you talk about this is day four. By day six, people find the body of Tim King.
Yeah. So Bruce Danto was a psychiatrist, and he loved the media, and his theory was that the killer might be trying to extract revenge on his family. And I think he thought he was a Vietnam veteran. And Bruce Danto really felt that he could possibly draw the killer out by communicating with him. And he had the lot of different machinations and orchestrations to try and draw the killer out. One of them was to go on the radio and drop some hints. He also wrote a letter to the killer that was published in the newspaper and said, "You can stop this now. And if you're reading this, please write me a letter." And indeed, somebody named Alan wrote him a letter. They never found out who the letter writer, who Alan actually was. He had the newspaper print a false weather report as a means to communicate with the killer. The police, he was sure that something about nuts in Squirrel Road, that the killer was mining his victim squirrel, searches for nuts. And later he put that out as a hint, and later police had a stakeout on Squirrel Road. It was not very fruitful, but interesting nonetheless. Of course, you know, during this time, while Tim was missing, the panic and fear was enormous. The case became national news. It was on the cover of People magazine. It was covered by Walter Cronkite. And while Tim was missing, the Oakland County prosecutor at the time, Brooks Patterson, had authorized law enforcement to pull over and search every vehicle on the streets over that weekend. Tim was kidnapped on Wednesday. So the following weekend, Friday and Saturday and Sunday night between 2 and 6 a.m., every vehicle on the streets was pulled over. It was a huge effort. It was also unconstitutional, but the reasoning was because the kids were killed within an hour of their bodies being dumped, they were hoping to intercept the killer. They were driven by the urgency to possibly find King alive. I think I said that they pulled over 2,000 cars, and one of the cops said, you know, no one complained.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about the Tim King investigation and this panic that hits the community, the county, and they're pulling over vehicles, and then they find Tim King's body.
Yes.
After 6 days.
Yes.
So now we're talking about, you have a task force that is organized, and with Lieutenant Robinson,
yes,
as the commander, and Detective Sergeant,
yes,
Kreese as his right-hand man, and Lieutenant Joseph Koning later is Robertson's successor. You
mm-hmm.
talk about at that time that there, at that time, there was a theory that was espoused by these three people. What was that theory regarding this Oakland County child killings?
That theory came after, in 1978, after the task force had shut down because they believed that they had run out of money. And reporters who would circle back to their police sources, you know, the following winter when it snowed, and on anniversaries, circle back to their police sources and to ask them why the case was never solved and what they thought had happened in the case. And with striking similarity, all of the officers spun a theory that said basically, you don't have to worry. It's been taken care of. Our theory is that the killer was likely from a wealthy family, and the wealthy family had arranged to have the killer institutionalized for life. And so long as no other children went missing, and nobody else would ever have to go through this again, it was put to rest. Some of the theories even went so far as to say that the families were aware that the killer had been institutionalized for life, and rather than risk going through a public trial and having to, you know, go through the agony of their, you know, public grief beyond display,
right,
they were okay with that and willing to put it behind them. It, you know, of course, decades later, it wasn't known until decades later how closely that theory aligned with what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. You write in this book, and you have a use this opportunity to educate and enlighten people in this book about the confluence of events as you describe it, the things that happened in the 70s, the laws that existed in the 70s and the laws that didn't exist in the 70s, and then just the burgeoning growth of the child pornography industry given those lack of laws and just
yeah.
the confluence of events. So you talk about the Cass Corridor in Detroit. You talk about Oakland County being the most one of the most affluent communities in the country. But Detroit, because of the recession, turns into a very murderous and crime-ridden place, doesn't it? So tell us a little bit about
yeah.
some of the things
yeah.
you discuss.
Sure. I most people don't realize, and certainly we didn't realize at the time, that child prostitution and child pornography was a multi-million dollar industry, and it completely underground, and it took off in part because there were it was highly profitable, and it took off in this country because there were actually no laws, no federal protections for children on the books to prevent it, you know, outside of a Juvenile Delinquency Act, which, you know, took care of runaways. There just weren't any protections for children from predators or you know, sexual exploitation. The Cass Corridor was a 10-block area just northwest of the city. It was once densely populated with immigrant families who had moved north to work in the auto factories. But as you said, the recession of the early 70s hit the city and the Cass Corridor even harder. And the area became a haven for the drug trades and sex workers, and kids ran wild. It became a quote-unquote predator's mecca. And a lot of child pornography took off there. Detective Williams, who I'll get into later, but the lead detective in the case spent 3 years unraveling the child prostitution and pornography rings that were operating really under our noses. And it's amazing, but he was able to identify several hundred men that they belonged to a very structured organization, and it was broken up into, you know, hidden cells, much like I would think the terrorist cells we think of today. And the
right.
leaders of the cells had organized seconds and lieutenants and sergeants, and he was able to identify quite a few, you know, politicians and labor leaders and auto executives who were involved in sharing kids.
Mm-hmm. So
you talk about. Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead.
You say it wasn't until the summer of 76 that the first thread of the nationwide child porn ring started to unravel. And it began in Michigan with the arrest of a gym teacher at a Catholic school in St. Clair County who had connections to the case, Gerald Richards. And that led to real estate developer. He told them about real estate developer Francis D. Sheldon,
yes,
who had purchased North Fox Island in Lace, Michigan. So what did he tell authorities? What did he tell authorities about Francis D. Sheldon and North Fox Island?
Gerald Richards worked for Francis Sheldon. Francis Sheldon was a wealthy real estate developer from Grosse Pointe, which is east of Detroit, and he came from one of the country's most prestigious families. He was, his grandfather was founder of the Packard Motor Company. His father was a land developer who was responsible for two of Detroit's most prestigious subdivisions. And, you know, Francis, of course, went to the best schools. And he was immensely wealthy. In 1976, he was worth several million dollars. But he led a double life. And turns out that he was the financier behind these child pornography rings. He financed the ring that we were talking about in the Cass Corridor, and he also created his own child pornography ring on North Fox Island. As you said, he purchased it in 1959, and he built an airstrip and several cabins, and then he recruited young boys to come to his so-called nature camp. It was called Brother Paul's Children's Mission, and
right,
he had it incorporated, and it was, you know, funded by our tax dollars, but instead it was a tax dodge. And
yeah,
kids up the island were filmed. The film was then shipped to Amsterdam, where it was developed and mass-produced and then sent through the mail. So in July of 1976, Gerald Richards, who was Francis Sheldon's underling, he was a photographer, and he was incorporated in the Brother Paul's mission. In those legal papers, Gerald Richards was the director, but he was also a school teacher in Port Huron, and he got picked up on a charge for molesting a young boy. And at that point, he tipped out Francis Sheldon. And just merely by coincidence, Francis Sheldon, I think, called Gerald Richards' wife at the time, and she informed Francis Sheldon that Gerald had been picked up by the police, and immediately Francis Sheldon emptied his condo in Ann Arbor and fled the country. Sadly, he was never extradited. Go ahead.
You talk about the also what Arthur's had said is that there was a filing cabinet that Sheldon would carry, would move from place to place. And then when they, you know, he had ample time to take off, cover his tracks, and they went, and of course, no filing cabinet whatsoever, no evidence left behind.
Right.
Right.
Right. But of course,
now,
you know, Gerald had pictures, and he was able to alert the St. Clair police of all of these other child pornography rings across the country. And so the Michigan State Police and the St. Clair Police here notified authorities in Tennessee and in Illinois and in other places. So police then became it became a cross-country raid.
Now tell us why it was called the Snow Killings, and then introduce Detective James Williams, and then Corey Williams.
Sure. There are two what I like to think of as really momentous things that happened in this case that I guess I call serendipitous or providential or planets aligning, however you want to think of it. But and
sure.
One of them is this. Corey Williams, he grew up in Berkeley where Christine Mihalik was from. His father, Lee Williams, James Lee Williams, as you said, was a police officer, and he not only worked on the case, Lee Williams was very good friends with Christine's grandfather. And Corey remembers the night Christine went missing because her frantic grandfather called Lee Williams frantic, saying Christine is missing.
Yeah.
Corey remembers being afraid and talking with his brothers at night about what they would do to get away from the killers if they had to. And it was interesting because his dad, worked the case like mad, and decades later, Corey would run across, familiar names, which were the names of cops that his dad had worked with. In any event, Corey joined the Army and became a U.S. paratrooper. And when he came home, he joined the police force in Livonia. And Livonia is the city where Tim's King body had been found. But in 2004, Corey Williams was assigned to re-examine a 15-year-old cold case. It was the homicide of the owner of the Detroit Cab Company. His name was Xavier Giller, and he'd been shot dead in his driveway after arriving home from work in 1989. And the killers stole Giller's, cash. He would, every night, he would bring home the day's earnings. And the killers took off driving across the country. So Corey is reading these old records, and he found that the killers and or the suspects at that time had been arrested in Pennsylvania on their cross-country trip, and he'd been arrested for armed robbery. His name was Richard Lawson. And Corey's reading these records and reading where Richard Lawson was trying to work out a plea deal, and he told these small town Pennsylvania cops that he had firsthand information about Michigan snow killings. Of course, the Pennsylvania detectives had no idea what he was talking about, but Williams knew instantly what he was talking about. The Oakland County child killings had also been called the snow killings because the killings had occurred in winter, and their abductions had often occurred when they had snowed. So now Williams is not only eager to solve the cold case of the cab killer, but he also is really anxious to find out what Richard Lawson knows about the snow killings. And since Richard Lawson was a prolific predator and knew an awful lot. He hung out, that was his stomping grounds, was the Cass Corridor. Richard Lawson was able to tell Williams that he, along with others, were prostituting children in the Cass Corridor to quote-unquote rich executives in the suburbs during the time of the OCCK case. So while investigating the Cass Corridor, Williams was able to secure a conviction and a lifetime sentence for Lawson, you know, for the murder of Xavier Giller. And he was also able to arrest and convict another pedophile who was Lawson's companion. His name was Ted Lamborghini, and he's now serving 3 consecutive life sentences, you know, for raping boys in the Cass Corridor. All along, you know, the King family had been closely following the Lawson and Lamborghini court proceedings because of what Detective Williams was learning about the Oakland County child killings and their connection to the Cass Corridor. And they had been deeply impressed by Detective Williams. And of course, this now leads us to Kathy King calling Corey Williams in July of 2007, because she said she had something of enormous importance that she wanted to talk to him about it. And this is what I consider to be kind of like the second providential part of the story, because what she had to tell him was a story that Barry King told me that night about that big white house across the street from the Kings. What she told Corey Williams was that Pat Coffey was a young boy who grew up across the street in that big white house from the Kings. He was a childhood friend of Tim King's, and he was deeply affected by the murder of his childhood friend, so much so that he decided to become a polygraph examiner. And in 2006, Patrick Coffey was at a convention in Las Vegas, and he was giving a presentation to the national group of polygraph examiners about a specialized way of conducting polygraphs. And in the audience was a man named Larry Wasser. Larry was president of the Michigan Polygraphers Association at the time, and Larry Wasser was very impressed by Patrick Coffey's presentation. And afterwards, he went up to him and he asked him if he would be interested in coming to Detroit to give the same presentation. And Pat said, well, of course, you know, you would be interested to know that my career ambition was born out of the tragedy of my childhood friend who was murdered. And perhaps you know the case. It was called the Oakland County Child Killing Case. And Wasser, I think, you know, Pat told me Wasser's jaw dropped, and he said, I know the case very well. And for whatever reason, lawyers have said it was an excited utterance, but for whatever reason, Wasser blurted out, "Well, I guess I can tell you this now because the suspect is dead and so is the attorney. But I tested the suspect who confessed to killing your neighbor boy." And in doing so...
Excuse me, let's stop to use this opportunity to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. My wife, Lisa, received her winter FabFitFun box a little while ago, and as always, she was anxious to try all the products she ordered. Because it's winter, it's dry skin and also dry hair, and so Lisa tried the Rhythm of the Rain hair mask and scalp detox. She loved how soothing it was on her scalp. Also, she wanted to try ACV Apple Cider Vinegar Dry Shampoo Powder. She said it refreshes her hairstyle when she needs to quickly. She loves it. She discovers all the latest beauty products with FabFitFun, and Lisa tells everyone about what a fantastic deal FabFitFun boxes are. FabFitFun are passionate about showcasing amazing women with 16 female-founded brands in the winter box. Choose from a super wide variety of products in which to order. No need to leave home to get these seasonal must-haves. Order your winter box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the Summer and Rose Cozy Robe or the ACV Dry Shampoo. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun. Now, Marnie, excuse me for interrupting you, and especially
not
during this very, very exciting admission. We now have this, as you say, this spontaneous utterance of something
mm-hmm.
that he likely, you know, didn't want to or didn't believe it was important to say. He just uttered it. Now, when there was going to be confirmation for what he had just said, what was his response?
He denied the conversation. And the reason he denied the conversation is because when he said that, he had violated polygrapher client privilege.
Right.
Which is the same thing as attorney client privilege. And
sure.
For a polygraph examiner who makes his life, you know, mining the truth, for him to have done that pretty much amounted to career suicide. But he did later deny to me that the conversation had ever even happened between him and Pat. And but when Kathy called Detective Williams and told him about this conversation, Detective Williams was able to get an investigative subpoena and force Wasser to come to the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. And, excuse me, Wasser, you know, fought the subpoena and he later negotiates a deal with the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office whereby he can give hints to what the name is because he claimed he could not remember the name
right.
In exchange for not having to go under oath. And finally, a name emerges, and that name is Christopher Brian Bush. Corey begins to investigate this name and really an avalanche of evidence, you know, came pouring down. Christopher Bush was the son of a prominent GM executive. He lived in Birmingham in Bloomfield Village, which in a sprawling five-bedroom home that was less than a five-mile radius of all four victims. His father, H. Lee Bush,
was chief financial officer for General Motors. A huge position. And Christopher Bush was a four-time convicted pedophile. And but he'd never seen the inside of a jail cell. And that's because H. Lee Bush hired a defense attorney whose name was Jane Burgess to defend his son. And H. Lee paid Jane Burgess handsomely and flew her around in the family's private airplane to plea bargain his son off of all these charges. So Detective Williams works alongside the Michigan State Police, Detective Gary Gray, and together, you know, they amassed an incredible amount of evidence against Chris Bush. Chris Bush's companion and fellow pedophile, Greg Green, told police they were, Greg Green and Christopher Bush were arrested at the same time in January of 1977. Mm-hmm. And when they were arrested, Greg Green told police in a separate interview that Christopher Bush had murdered Mark Stebbins. Christopher Bush's nephew told Detective Williams that, and Christopher Bush unfortunately was abusing his nephew, and Christopher Bush's nephew told Detective Williams that his uncle Chris had taken him to the Hunter Maple Pharmacy during the height of the killings, and he pointed to Tim King. I mean, what I mean to say is that the case was all over the papers, and so right. The nephew said, "What is this?" And he took his nephew to the parking lot and said, "You know, Tim King was standing right over there." He pointed to the area. When Chris Bush was interrogated in Flint, he was asked where he'd like to pick up boys. And Bush recited in chronological order the three sites of the first three victims' abductions.
Right.
And I think it's interesting to note that Greg Green, who did not come from a family of means like Chris Bush did, was arrested for the same charge with the same kid at the exact same time as Gregory Green. I'm sorry, as Chris Bush, and he received a life sentence, and Chris Bush walked. So money and power can get you a lot of things. Go ahead.
You also have a witness that Williams finds, and it's the first Flint, Michigan victim, Kenny Bowman. So he tells of Green and both of these people
Bush.
Together.
Yeah.
Bush. He told of both of them and saying that Green was far more violent than Bush as well.
Yes, of the two. And he was. He was very violent, and one of the other victims he was violent with, we suspect, is Vince Gunnels, who was a friend of Kenny Bowman. He was a friend of Chris Bush's nephews. They had all grown up in Flint together, and Vince Gunnels, we think, must have been severely beaten by Greg Green, because Greg Green, when asked about
I think he was asked who his enemies were or who was the person he would most likely like to see dead, and he said Vince Gunnels. But when Vince Gunnels was interviewed and interrogated by Corey Williams, Vince Gunnels refused to say that he ever even knew Greg Green. So, interestingly enough, Vince Gunnels was found to be a mitochondrial DNA match to, or what they'd rather call, he shared the same profile consistency, DNA profile consistency of, excuse me, a hair that was found on the sweater of Christine Mihalik. He also failed a polygraph on the case. And to me, Vince, he was a victim of Chris Bush, that he had no idea how he could have been connected to the hair. He said, you know, maybe it was because I was in the car. I was in Chris Bush's car. And, you know, he also lied about knowing Greg Green, which was very curious. I should say the most damning evidence, I think, that Detective Williams found was in Chris Bush's suicide scene. And it was so staged that not many people believe that it was a suicide. But Chris Bush was found dead in his bedroom of his parents' home in November of 1978. Tim King was the last victim, so that would have been in March of 77, so a little more than a year. And he was found dead from a hunting rifle wound that, curiously enough, was shot right between his eyes. Mm-hmm. He had a blood alcohol level of 0.41, which I understand is near lethal. And so it's really questionable as to how he could have managed to, you know, shoot himself with a hunting rifle. There was no blood spatter on the walls. And police found, when they responded to the scene, the drawing of a young boy.
That's right, yes.
It was a sketch. And the young boy was screaming in anguish, and he resembled Mark Stebbins. It was taped to the wall. There were ropes in the middle of the closet floor. There was a shotgun shell from a 12-gauge shotgun that was left very conspicuously on the dresser. You know, of course, Williams wondered, he's looking at photos of all this. He's wondering where the ropes that are, and could they possibly have been used to have bound Mark Stebbins and Timothy King. It was a 12-gauge shotgun that had been used to kill Joe Robinson. But, of course, by 1978, police had tossed all that evidence, and the body was cremated days later. So, in any event, Williams presented the entire case to Jessica Cooper, who had taken
office. She was the Oakland County prosecutor, and she'd taken office in March of 2009. I'm sorry, she'd taken office in January of 2009, and he first presented all the evidence to her, but she was nonplussed. She was not moved at all, and she said, come back when you have more evidence. I think it's important to remind you, you know, that Corey Williams works in Wayne County, and his boss is Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy.
Right.
Whatever Jessica Cooper's motivations were, and some have said that Prosecutor Cooper was dead set against the Bush lead because she was friends with both Chris Bush's attorney, Jane Burgess, who had passed away, and or Larry Wasser, the disgraced polygraph examiner, or whether she waged war with her counterpart, you know, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, out of pure
right.
political ambition, whatever the case was, she eventually got Detective Williams killed out the task force. She lied about critical evidence that was found in 2012, and she repeatedly discounted the Chris Bush lead. She treated Barry King horribly, and you know, thereafter just dismissed the Bush lead and said that it was a non-starter.
We have to explain though that the Barry King, his wife didn't want to have anything to do with this. She wanted to just have the memories of Tim and that's it. But he was
exactly.
a fighter, and so he always pressed the authorities for information. And he is the
yes.
one. He and his family, Kathy Broad King, who also brought the first lead, the lead about Chris Bush. To authorities.
Exactly.
And so a part of this is, you say, you're not really sure how big a role politics plays in there, but also just the ego that you see many times between
yeah.
jurisdictions, where Cooper accuses Worthy of tipping off, of leaking information, or Williams leaking information,
yes.
whereas both of them just want to involve Barry King, who's an attorney, and his family, who have done good work, and they believe deserve not only to know what's going on in this investigation and be apprised of it, but also that they deserve to know this information. And so
exactly.
Cooper has issues with that. And also the King family has said, if we don't get the kind of answers that we're looking for, then we're going to go to the media. And so Williams
yeah.
warned Cooper that was the case. He wasn't threatening on behalf of them. He was just warning
exactly.
her, apprising her to the reality of the situation.
Exactly. But that's not the way she saw it. You know, she decried him as a leak. In October 2009, I broke the Bush lead. And because, as you say, Barry King followed through on a threat because they were being stonewalled. Nobody except Wayne County would give him any information on the very lead, you know, his family was responsible for developing. He mounted a years-long FOIA lawsuit, which Jessica Cooper fought all the way to the Supreme Court. Barry King, made it his mission in life to seek justice for his son. He talked to anyone who would listen, senior men's clubs, press conferences, and he felt sure that the reason law enforcement would not talk to him about the Christopher Bush case is because they didn't want the public to know that they had covered up Chris Bush long ago to save face. I you know, there's a really important point to be made here, and it's one that Chris King impressed upon me long ago, and that is that had that providential conversation never happened between Patrick Coffey, the polygrapher who was also a family friend, and Larry Wasser, had that conversation never occurred, we would not know about Christopher Bush. We wouldn't be talking about Christopher Bush. I wouldn't have written a book. None of this evidence would have ever come to light. And that's because it wasn't supposed to. That's by design. and that's kind of the premise of my book. I think I found evidence, and the book lays bare that at the site of the suicide scene, the Michigan State Police and members of the Oakland County Task Force who reported to the scene realized at that suicide scene that they had, you know, they had already arrested Christopher Bush at the height of the panic, but then they had let him go and they had released him. And only weeks after they released him, the fourth victim, Timothy King, was snatched and killed. And Corey Williams said as much too. He said he believed that the officers who arrived at that scene, and, you know, a scene that really just screamed child killer, what with the drawing and the shotgun shell and the ropes, they had to have gone back and ran Bush's name against their records and discovered that he was a suspect that had been cleared by a polygraph and freed, only weeks before Tim King died. And so rather than expose the fact that they had him and let him go, they decided to close the door on investigating, you know, Bush's involvement when they had the chance.
Right.
And I talked to who was at the scene and told me just that. He's in Florida now. His name is James Spiker. And he said, yeah, they tried to keep it confidential. As I remember, it was, you know, guys, let's just be cool about this. They didn't want the public to know that they, you know, had let their guard down. And as time went on and the killing stopped, that just gave more credence to the fact that he was the killer. And Spiker said, you know, we thought, sure, the task force was going to say, you know, they'd solved it and closed the door on the case. But instead they shut it down.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about that they just shut this down. It's obvious, and your investigation and Corey Williams' investigation, that this was a cover-up and that there was wealthy people involved. But what we haven't really described is that this Corey Williams, he was obsessed with this case. And it's amazing, amazing the links and the lengths that he did, that he explored, all the links, all the connections, all of the deviants and sex offenders that were connected and confronted them. And it's very fascinating to see him confront people, bluff them, and just deal with them and express his true feelings about these people.
Yes, yes.
He was quite obsessed with this case.
Yeah, yeah. And
Yeah, there was not one stone left unturned. There was, you know, not one lady did not chase. And he retired, as you know, at the end of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had investigated the case for 14 years. I mean, imagine trying to, you know, solve the case. Your father could not. He was very close with the King family. you know, and it was, I imagine, you know, it was very hard for him to retire. Well, I know it was very hard for him to retire. But at least he could be secure in the knowledge that he put away for life several horrible, evil predators who ruin the lives, really, of scores of untold kids, you know, whose lives were really ruined by at the hands of these evil men. I mean, Richard Lawson and Ted Lamborghini. And I think in September of 2018, I was with him when he went to the Kings, and he was able to tell Barry and Chris and Mark that indeed they'd been right all along, that there was a cover-up to save face. He had produced a 3-page report that he compiled on the theory of his cover-up, and he told them, you know, the bottom line was, you know, there were cops who covered their asses once they found Bush dead. And of course, and he also, both he and Kim Worthy, nobody did more to advance this case than Wayne County, Kim Worthy, and Detective Coy Williams. And but they weren't running the show. The Michigan State Police and the Oakland County prosecutors were. And he was able to, and of course the Kings knew this, he was able to tell them that, you know, the most egregious decision was the decision to keep the King family in the dark about everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have to say the Kings were not surprised, and that there was little comfort in the recognition that, you know, I think Chris said, we've been victimized twice, you know, first by a predator and then second by a system that, you know, that played us.
Yeah.
So the good news is, in August this past year, Jessica Cooper was voted out of office. Barry King passed away right before Thanksgiving this year. I was able to hand him the book, which was wonderful for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, I hope, at least I know, I think I know that the book served as a sense of vindication for him.
Yeah.
I'm happy to say that since the book has been published, more than a few new leads have surfaced, and some victims, some very courageous victims have come forward. So, you know, the truth matters.
Mm-hmm. You talked about throughout this book, the providence and or divine intervention in a couple key points, but what adds to the horror of this, of these innocent children being abducted and tortured and held and killed, and we didn't get into a lot of the graphic detail. But what was fascinating, and again, this comes up over and over again, is the premonition by Jill Robinson with her mother just months before. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, she did. These parents are such amazing people. Carol Self, Jill's mother, was divorced at the time, and she was the mother of three young girls, the oldest. And she had said that Jill was having teenage issues. She had recently moved to Royal Oak to a new home. Her mother decided to send her to a therapist just to make sure she was adjusting well. And the therapist suggested that Jill get a cat. And so Jill got a cat. And, but Jill was really, really almost wise beyond her years. From her mother's description, I would describe her as an old soul. She not only read books, she read the newspapers. And she described one night saying prayers with Jill, and Jill broke down into tears, and she said, "Jill, you know, what's the matter?" And Jill said, "I don't know why, but I've been having dreams and nightmares, and I think I'm going to be killed. I think I'm going to be shot." And, you know, of course, I think it was after that, now that I think of it, that Carol took Jill to someone she could talk to. But, you know, for as much as she could try to console her child and say that's not going to happen, of course, I can't imagine the grief after the fact. You know, knowing that your daughter had a premonition.
It's interesting, too, that none of the other victims were shot. And so you just surmise or suggest that there was a reason for that. But again, adding to less coincidental this could possibly be.
There is a theory about Jill being shot that I should mention, because the other three were suffocated, and it was thought that perhaps Jill was suffocated as well. But when they laid her down on the side of the highway, Jill at the time was wearing her backpack, the backpack she had been wearing when she disappeared. And it was thought that when they laid her down, perhaps the pressure of the backpack on her back and on her lungs made her express a hush of air. And perhaps to the killer, they thought, "Oh, she's breathing. She's still breathing. She's alive." And then got the shotgun to shoot her in the face. But we don't know.
We spoke about Frances Sheldon and the kind of motivation. We didn't really draw the lines to him except to talk about that he was so worried that he fled the country. But you do talk about in the end of the book where he went. You follow him. You track him to find out where he went to and why and how he was able to escape and stay out of the country. Tell us a little bit about what you found about Sheldon Francis. Francis Sheldon, pardon me.
Yeah, that's all right. There were numerous sightings of him reported in the years after he fled the country. He was sighted in Amsterdam. He was rumored to have been married and was living in France. He I think he was sighted in the West Indies. Even today, even as recent as today, Corey Williams got somebody sent him a photo of, supposedly it's Francis Sheldon sitting in an orphanage in Africa with a bunch of
wow.
little kids around him. You know, the mysteries abound. But the Michigan State Police court files records say that he passed away, I believe it was in 1996. But he was never held to account. He sent letters to some of the kids that he had groomed, letters of apology. You know, he fronted a lot of his favorite, a lot of his favorites. He funded their college educations. And so he sent letters of explanation to at least one of them that I know, saying that he was sorry that an emergency had come up and he had to take a long trip. But, you know, these people groom their victims so much so that they believe they have a real relationship with them, a relationship akin to love. And that young man that I spoke of in Charlevoix ended up taking his life because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and the other interesting thing too is, and I won't go on about this, but so many people say when talking about the child pornography rings and people like Francis Sheldon, how could this have happened? You know, we're so appalled at the horror of children being subjected to such things. And I have to say, I think our own sense of denial is to be blamed. This was happening underneath our noses, and we have only to look at the Catholic Church or, you know, Jerry Sandusky to know that many of us turned a blind eye because it was too abhorrent to be believed. But it goes on, and it goes on still, and to this day. It's called sexual trafficking. And, you know, some people have said that Francis Sheldon was, or rather that Jeffrey Epstein is the modern day equivalent of Francis Sheldon because, you know, they both own private islands. And so.
Yes, what was once a very alarming situation got worse. In 2008, there was federal legislation to stamp out child pornography. However, as you say, there's so many cases now that they simply just have to prioritize by age. And if you know, and that sure sounds like they got to prioritize by the youngest people, children that are being abused and used and traded and killed.
And sold.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the snow killings inside the Oakland County Child Killer Investigation. It's been fascinating. Is there a website or a Facebook page that people might take a look more information about this?
Sure.
Tell us about that.
Sure. And thank you, Dan, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
My website is called simply thesnowkillings.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Marnie Rich-Keenan, for the snow killings inside the Oakland County Child Killer Investigation. Incredible. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
I appreciate it. You too. Thank you, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Good night.